its current state, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. It's 90.5 WKAR. Dennis Cawthorn later this hour, veteran Michigan lobbyist, attorney, business owner, and Mackinac Island mystic. He has spent over 50 years visiting and working on and representing Mackinac Island. He ran the Mackinac Island State Park Commission, and he's put everything he knows in a new book, Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal. So if you can't make it to Mackinac Island, consider curling up with the book. Hope you can stay with us here for the next hour to start out our program today with August just about behind us. Current State takes a look back at Michigan's biggest statewide stories with our monthly reporter roundtable. We welcome back off-the-record host Tim Skubick, seen on WKAR-TV.
How you doing, man?
Hi, Tim. Kathy Gray of Gannett Newspapers.
Hello.
A.K.A. the Detroit Free Press, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's great to have Zach Korchow back from Gongwer News. Hi, Zach.
Morning.
Wolf hunting will continue in Michigan's western UP after yesterday's House vote. Kathy, you covered this for Gannett. How did majority Republicans defend their votes supporting the hunt?
Well, they defended their vote because they say that the wolves are a danger up in the UP. They are killing livestock. They're killing pets. They are, you know, one representative talked about how they are gathering in parking lots. They're encroaching in communities, and they just need to be dealt with. The vote was 65 to 43, I think. And it was pretty close to what they voted on, the same thing, basically, last year. A few people peeled off, but...
And they characterized the opposition to this as special interest opposition.
Well, the Humane Society of the United States is the one who bankrolled the two petition drives. They are out of state, but there were a lot of people, local people, who collected signatures. So it's kind of a double-edged sword there.
Voters will still see two proposals involving wolf hunting on the ballot in November. What's the significance of those, Zach?
Well, it appears it will decide whether there will be wolf hunting this year or not. Now, what happened yesterday means there will be wolf hunting for sure starting in 2015, barring some successful court challenge. But the two earlier laws that are up for referendum on the November ballot, should voters decide to keep those laws, there will be wolf hunting this year. It may be truncated as far as how much of a season. But if they vote no and decide to repeal those two earlier wolf hunting laws, there will then be a few months period where there is no authorization for wolf hunting in Michigan, and thus there would not be a season this year.
The real nexus of this debate was who gets to decide whether we have a wolf hunting season. The petition people said the citizens are fully qualified to do this, put it on the ballot and let them decide. The Michigan House and the Senate a couple weeks ago said, no, we think the DNR is the best place to have this done. And so far, the DNR is winning.
And this repeats, Tim, a pattern of GOP majority, the GOP majority legislature enacting legislation that heads off a popular vote in the citizens on a citizens ballot initiative. It already happened once this year in the minimum wage.
Well, and also the Democrats would point out that it happened on emergency manager. The people said no to emergency manager. The governor and lawmakers come back and said, yeah, we heard you. Now let's rewrite the law. So it becomes part of a pattern that in one of the pieces the Democrats are playing that the Republicans are basically riding roughshod over the people. The Republicans would say, look, we represent all of the people. And many of these petition drives were 200, 300,000 people. Well, Randy Richardville said the other day, the Republican leader, I represent 9 million people. I've got to be responsible to them, not a vocal minority, quote, end quote.
And the state constitution does allow for this option. It is legal. Is this wearing really thin for Democrats?
Oh, absolutely. The one issue that Tim didn't mention was the abortion insurance bill that the legislature voted on instead of letting it go to a vote of the people. Who knows what would have happened at the ballot? I'm not sure. But, you know, there was one Democrat, Brandon Dillon, yesterday who says, I'm getting so tired of this constant cutting away of our rights. to vote, to be heard. So, the Democrats are using it. It's going to become an election issue. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. For the first time in over a year, we get up this morning and find that Mark Schauer leads incumbent Governor Rick Snyder. This is in the latest Epic MRA poll. Zach Gongwer News reports on this. What are the details here?
Well, the numbers show 45% favoring Mark Schauer and 43% favoring Rick Snyder. Now, that is within the polls, plus or minus 4 percentage point margin of error, so it's not a statistically significant lead, but it is a politically significant moment because, as you said, this is the first time in 14 months that any poll from any public poll from a major firm has shown Mark Schauer ahead, and it really continues at least a two-month pattern where Rick Snyder went from a pretty consistent 5 to 10 point lead to more and more tightening, and now Mark Schauer has pulled ahead, and this has gotten a lot of people's attention. Democrats were already getting really encouraged and excited about Mark Schauer, thinking, "Boy, this guy's got a shot at this thing. This isn't going to be, a sure loss like we thought." And now you're starting to hear from some Republicans who are getting nervous and wondering what is happening. Why hasn't the governor's campaign been more assertive? Why hasn't it done more to define Mark Schauer? And how can the governor really be behind at this stage?
Is that the issue, the Snyder campaign not being assertive enough?
Well, it's run some interesting commercials. The woman from Ann Arbor who had a flatbread company. I mean, what did that have to do with anything other than the fact that the governor helped her? Or the scuba diving commercial with the saxophone music in the background. I suspect that the saxophone is going to be thrown in the closet and the scuba gear will be thrown there along with it. Some people are saying the governor needs to get out and do some campaigning and stop being governor. But you know what? This is what this governor does. His job is to be governor of the state, and I'm not saying that he won't campaign, but a lot of people are waiting to see what the heck it's going to be and what's he going to say.
Well, and this also comes at a time when he has been facing a lot of controversies. He's had the prison food contract, which has been very controversial over the last 6 months. He's had the head of MSHTA who's had to resign because of exorbitant expense accounts.
It hasn't been a great few months for the administration.
It hasn't. And when the flood hit Detroit and all the freeways were closed and everybody's basement was flooded, Rick Snyder was up in the UP. Now, it took him 5 days to make any significant appearances down in that area.
He came down the day after.
Well, he did, but he flew over.
Right.
He didn't meet with any of the
helicopter, right?
He didn't meet with any of the local officials. He viewed it from the air. And then it took him another 4 or 5 days for him to get down and start helping people clean up.
But you pointed out in an MLive column, Tim, that the governor, I mean, if there were a media competition stemming from how the candidates looked responding to the Detroit flood, advantage Snyder.
Well, he owns a helicopter. Last time I checked, there is no Schauer jet copter, okay? He was relegated to driving around in a car. The interesting thing here was, to underscore that point, Schauer announced first that he would help clean up some of the basements of some of the people who were flooded. And within hours, the governor said, hey, we're going to do that too. The TV camera showed up for the governor. They didn't show up for Schauer. So that is one of the advantages of the incumbency. And while he was late coming to the party on showing up with the people, I think they've tried to regroup. And the next question, guys, will be when the FEMA people show up with the checks from the Obama administration, will Mark Schauer be invited to the party to hand out the checks, or will it only be a governor-only appearance? That'll be an interesting story.
He won't, but I do think it's very illustrative of what's been happening, that Schauer got down there first. How could the governor's people let him stay in the Upper Peninsula? I do not understand that. That's when you get the lieutenant governor to go in and fill in for you. I mean, this was a legitimate crisis. And how the governor's people could say, well, yeah, we'll send the governor back, 400 miles away from one of the worst floods, Metro Detroit, which, oh, by the way, has millions of voters has ever seen. They really should have gotten him down there first. And, yeah, over the long haul, the governor's going to get more exposure and will be able to play out the advantages of his incumbency. But I do think that was a bit of a warning sign or a signal that Mark Schauer has been outfoxing him for some time now.
Well, and the governor also went on a Detroit radio station and said that he felt their pain.
The vacation home
because
comment.
A tree had fallen on the roof of his $1 million vacation home on Gun Lake. And the Democrats are definitely using that one, too.
One word. Romney.
Yeah.
What,
out
explain,
of touch.
Explain what you... Oh, okay, disconnect.
Well, yeah. I mean, look what the Obama people did with Mr. Romney. They did it during the summer before the campaign. They painted him somebody who was not one of us, was out of touch with reality. And whether the governor people want to acknowledge this or not, that is, this is the beginning of the same kind of theme that I think the Democrats will try to weave between now and November. The $1.1 million cottage is not the sort of thing that folks have up north in Houghton Lake. And I asked the governor about this at the end of the year, and he admitted that he could have a Romney problem, but he also says, you know what, there's a major difference. I worked for my money. I was successful on my own. My first job was a buck and a half an hour, okay? Not to say that Mr. Romney fell into his wealth, but there is a different narrative there that they will try to paint. But don't you guys think that the Romney issue will be raised one way or the other?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Mark Schauer is putting a huge emphasis on the wealthy versus the middle class. I mean, that is a major emphasis. And Rick Snyder's wealth, even though he did start with from modest means, he's a very wealthy man now, and the Democrats are going to try to play up that distinction.
Zach Gortow, Kathy Gray, and Tim Skubick, our guests today on Current State's Month in Review segment, looking back on August. Back to these poll result numbers, though. Will the Snyder Reelection Organization be more willing or less willing to debate in light of these numbers? Is this going to be a factor in that?
Well, if there was any thought among the governor's people about trying to avoid a debate, I think that's pretty much out the window. Now, the question will be the number. There was one debate 4 years ago. I'm thinking that we're probably looking at an absolute maximum of two this year, and most likely there will probably be one. But I don't see how the governor can avoid a debate with Mark Schauer when it's a clear dead heat right now.
I digress. I think he can get away without doing debates. I do not hear the people are not storming the Bastille. Where are our gubernatorial? I wish they were. Okay. Obviously, our bias is we need to have debates. It's the right thing to do. They can't even agree on the time that they're going to meet for the Detroit Economic Club. And the governor said at the convention, until we get that resolved, everything else is, quote, premature. I mean, read between the lines on that. What did you make of that?
I make of it that he doesn't want to do it, and he doesn't need to.
He doesn't want to give Schauer the exposure.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if Schauer and he are on the same stage, it puts them on the same level.
The Economic Club is the one you want to do because it's not a debate.
Right.
It's a joint appearance. They won't even talk to one another, and they will answer maybe the same questions, but they'll walk back and forth to the podium. I mean, it's what it is.
And explain the significance of Diane Byrum, Democratic insider, veteran legislator, being identified as the Democratic debate negotiator. What is going on there?
Well, John Cherry is also the debate negotiator for Gary Peters, the Senate candidate, and these are experienced Democrats who can get out there and say, "Hey, they're not answering my calls.
Right?
They just don't want a debate." And they're the ones who can get the attention. They're well-known. People are going to listen to them. Media might respond to them when they get out there to hammer the podium and say, we're not going to have debates, and that's just wrong.
Republican U.S. Senate candidate Terry Lynn Land is keeping a low profile. Why, and is that apt to change?
In answer to your last part of that, I don't think it is apt to change because she's been doing this for a year, which is basically avoiding, what would be considered quote-unquote public events. She's done lots of events, but you don't see her typically announce, I will be at such and such place at such and such time. Feel free, inviting hundreds of people or whatnot, letting the news media know in advance that she's going
Why
to be
not?
There.
Why not?
She doesn't want the exposure. She doesn't want a gotcha moment. She had one up in Mackinac, and it was disastrous. And she needs to avoid that at all costs.
Have any of you three had any microphone contact with Terry Lynn Land?
I've had three interviews with her, and on all three occasions she has walked off camera.
The last time I spoke to Terry Lynn Land was in September of last year on Mackinac Island. Her campaign has denied all interview requests since then to me.
Mm. It's an interesting strategy. And you know what? It could work. I mean, let's think about it. Again, people are not storming the Bastille for debates. I don't hear anybody complain. Where's Terry Lynn Land? She's not talking about
the
issues.
Same dynamic as with the governor. Well, similar.
No, because the governor will talk to the media.
The governor's available.
The governor is very available to the media. Terry Lynn Land has not been at the Republican convention last weekend. She kept walking across the room right in front of the media table and not stopping to chat, whereas all the other politicians there, that's what they did.
Did this change after the Mackinac Island incident?
No, this was in place before that, okay. And that was – it just – you know, I mean, I think Tim could probably describe the blow-by-blow of what happened better, but because he was there, but I wasn't. But that was not scripted or planned, and she – you know, finally, the reporters who had months, literally months of questions they wanted to ask her had their chance, and she couldn't handle it at the time.
Both state party nominating conventions were held last weekend. The main event was an effort by Tea Party Republican Wes Nakagiri to become the party's nominee for lieutenant governor over Brian Kelly. That effort was unsuccessful. How did this unfold last weekend exactly?
I mean, basically the Kelly people had been working this for months to recruit precinct delegates to run. These are the folks at the very bottom of your August primary ballot. Party people, essentially. They got more of their people elected and running and elected in August. Then they dominated the county party conventions a week or so later. And it's funny because after the county conventions, the Kelly people said, we think we control 65% of the state convention delegates. What was Brian Kelly's vote percentage?
65%.
Yeah. That tells you it was a very sophisticated effort.
They can count.
Yeah.
But it wasn't necessarily a kumbaya moment. Wes Nakagiri got up there and asked for a unanimous ballot once it was realized that Kelly was going to win handily. But he came back on Monday and said he didn't know if he was going to vote for Snyder.
It was a curious moment at the convention. Nakagiri does the appropriate thing to say, let's make it unanimous. He's prepared to walk off the stage. Bobby Shostak, the Republican chair, and Mr. Kelly are standing there, and they're whispering. He goes back to the microphone, having been advised that maybe he needs to say a little more. And he said, you know, if we're really going to beat the Democrats, we've got to be united. And then he talks to the media on Monday and says, I'm just not sure I'm there.
Quote, I don't think the excitement is there for Snyder-Kelly the way it was in 2010.
Well, this is another problem for the governor. Depending on, quote, how many people there are that are Tea Party folks, okay, do they show up? Do they vote for the ticket? Do they show up and not vote for the ticket? Or do they just stay home? It is an X factor and in a close race, potentially a deciding factor. I'm not saying it will be. But I would think as they walked out of the convention saying that we were united, knowing that they weren't united, what do the Snyder people do to try to put Humpty Dumpty back together again? And I'm not sure they can.
Is this something that you will be watching over the next, certainly between now and November, whether the Michigan GOP is more united or more divided?
You know, I think
that's the $64 question.
I think he's got Republican voters. This is a very small element that's ready to, you know, walk out of the tent, so to speak. I mean, if you look at polls for some time now, really over his whole, going back to even 2010, after he won the nomination, even though a lot of conservatives were upset about him winning, right afterward, the base was right behind him. I think in yesterday's Epic MRA poll, he's got 80%. I think it's something like 82, 83% of Republican voters saying they're going to vote for him. That's where you want to be. You'd expect to have between 80 to 90% of your base voting for you. There's just no sign of some sort of mass defection right now. Yeah, if the race comes down to a few thousand votes, it could be one of many things that would decide it, but I don't see this right now being at critical mass.
I wonder if the same kind of organizing effort that went into the convention will also continue and play into the general election, and the organization will just get out the vote.
Well, both
they'll
both
just
parties,
execute.
Both parties have got, you know, significant turnout plans that they're ready to execute for November.
Lon Johnson is putting all his money on anger. We want to get the Democrats angry enough that those 900,000 that abandoned Verge Bonaro 4 years ago will show up in November.
Is that happening?
We're about to find out.
It appears to be working. You look at why Showers in the lead now.
This is
Democratic base coming home. I think that goes to the Dems' efforts.
And to his credit, Mr. Johnson has said, if we don't turn them out, quote, we lose. Simple as that.
Here in Lansing, the Democratic convention was forecast to be a love fest, was it?
For the most part, it was a very small love fest. It was not There were not a ton of people there. They said that they had 1,700 people. There were 5,000 in Novi for the Republican convention. There weren't 1,700 people there. But there weren't a whole lot of contentious races. There was one hiccup.
Judge Bill Murphy.
Right. He has anti-abortion views. The Women's Caucus were upset about that. Some progressive caucuses were upset about that. And when he was nominated, there was probably several dozen people who were standing up holding signs that said women are watching. So that was kind of the only real hiccup in the convention.
Which is exactly the way Mr. Johnson won it. No controversy, no off-message stuff, no bad press coming out of this. There's no revolt going on in the Democratic Party, he will say. Look at what's going on in Novi. He compared the convention in Novi as to a goat rodeo, which I thought was an interesting. Have you ever seen a goat rodeo? I don't know where that soundbite came from, but it got my attention.
Yeah, I got my iPad handy. Google goat,
goat rodeo. See what you come up with.
Well, we mentioned some of the setbacks for the Snyder administration here in recent months. We won't spend an awful lot of time on this, but we did touch on Aramark, the embattled prison food service provider. There was anticipation that Aramark could be cut loose after a series of cringe-inducing missteps, maggots near food, intimate contact between Aramark workers and prisoners. What do you make of the state's willingness to keep Aramark? They're still on
board.
Here
was part of the problem. They were facing a huge multi-million-dollar, multi-year lawsuit if they canceled the contract. Okay, Aramark hauls them into court. And I think the governor's people did the calculus and say, we probably don't want to do that. Is there a plan B? I think some folks were surprised in town that the contract was not canceled. But don't go so fast on the maggot thing. I think the administration is looking into what was really going on. Was this a matter of, stuff shows up in Ohio and Michigan at the same time in the middle of a controversy. So I think they're going to try to prove that maybe the unions were behind that.
Well, I mean, the maggots is one thing. The contact between workers and inmates is a whole different thing. They've had more than 75, 80 people who have been let go from Aramark since the contract has been in place, and it's only been in place for 8 months. And that's a lot of people that have had to be let go because of that. So I think that, the maggot thing certainly gets more attention, but So does sex between workers and inmates.
There was growing anticipation this month of taxing e-cigarettes here in Michigan, but it took some back and forth before we arrived where we're at. What is the back and forth on taxing e-cigarettes all about?
Well, supposedly there is a, quote, compromise between Mr. Richardville and the governor to tax it at a lower rate and to recognize it as a tobacco product. The problem is Senator Rick Jones, one of the sponsors, says, I don't agree with that at all. It's not a tobacco product. We're trying to help people get off of cigarettes, and here we are taxing them.
Nicotine, but not tobacco.
He says the vapor that goes up is not smoke. But he also concedes that the governor will probably get his way, and we may see some vote on this before the end of the year to tax it.
You see a two-tier tax result here?
I have no idea what they're going to do on that.
Okay. The summer has flown by, as it always seems to do. Did the legislature, did the governor get stuff done more or less over the summer? Or was it?
No, it was not a working summer in the sense of legislation. Everyone was focused on the primary.
I just remember the roads, for example, a discussion was going to continue over road funding
this
over
afternoon,
the summer.
2:00.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
What happens this afternoon at 2?
They'll meet again.
Nothing happened at the first meeting. Nothing of significance happened at the work group meeting. So roads is still a huge question mark.
What are all of you looking at the next few days, the next few weeks?
Well, I think it's going to be really important what the next series of polls says on the governor's race. It's always possible that one poll can be an outlier, but we haven't seen that in the governor's race so far. Everyone went crazy when a firm called Public Policy Polling, which has a pretty good reputation in the state, showed it a dead heat a few months ago and thought, well, that can't be right. But it turned out it was, because it seemed every other poll followed up showing it tight as well. Will we start to see other surveys showing Mark Schauer ahead? The governor's campaign spokesperson yesterday referred to that poll as garbage. It's not going to look so good if all the other surveys come out showing the same thing.
Apparently she did not take her RPA pill. That was a nasty thing to say, garbage. I'm sure Mr. Porn appreciated that. Here's what's going to happen. After Labor Day, you're going to see one commercial after another from Rick Snyder. He will be on the air every day, every hour, 24/7 up until the election, and watch the numbers change as a result of that or not. It'll be fascinating to watch.
Well, and you'll see, I mean, Vice President Joe Biden is coming into town on Monday for the traditional Labor Day festivities in Detroit. I'm sure Mark Schauer will be down there. Gary Peters will be down there. So the Democrats are going to be very active as well.
It's been our Month in Review segment. We do it monthly, and we want to thank our guest, Tim Skubick, seen on WKAR-TV on statewide. Off the record, Kathy Gray of Gannett Newspapers, the Detroit Free Press, Zach Gorchow of Gongmer News. Many thanks to all of you.
Thanks, Mark. Sure.
Thanks.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Many thanks for joining us. The housing market in Michigan is much healthier today than it was 4 years ago. Foreclosure rates have been steadily declining in that time, though market watchers say there was a slight uptick in filings in July. While the sheer number of people losing their homes is dropping, the foreclosure problem is by no means gone. And Current State's Kevin Lavery attended a property auction held by the Ingham County Treasurer's Office to learn more about the process. He joins me now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. Ingham County holds two or three of these auctions each year. This one drew a mix of people looking for a good deal on a home, most of which are in the city of Lansing. I spoke with several people there, including Ingham County Treasurer Eric Schertzing, who says that he tries to get to know the buyers who come shopping for a bargain.
We have investors that rent properties, we have investors that fix them up and sell, and the ones I really like are folks that are actually looking for a home to buy, fix up, and move they and their family into. It runs the full gamut. What we're looking for as county treasurer is a good outcome for the properties, and we have a number of things that we do to try to help make sure there's a good outcome.
Schertzing says while the number of mortgage foreclosures in Michigan has fallen dramatically since the peak of the Great Recession, the incidence of people who can't pay their property taxes remains, in his words, stubbornly high.
I think we're going to continue to see this. I think it's the change in the economy where a lot of better paying jobs were lost going into the Great Recession, and the jobs that have replaced them are paying less. And so there's a whole group of individuals, unfortunately, that continue to struggle and will continue to struggle even more to maintain home ownership.
As prospective bidders lined up to register, I met Kendall Perry. He was here with his friend John Schimp. Perry already owns some property, but the two were looking for something near Old Town they could fix and flip.
He actually wants to do it. He does all the work. I have an existing property. It's a 7-unit building in Old Town Lansing, and it's my primary residence. I had property before, offloaded everything except for this one that I live in, and he does all of the work, and he does great work. So he actually was the impetus for this. He kind of wanted to do it, and I said, fine. You know, the bidding starts at $5,200. And I can put $5,000 toward that if he'll do the work. So
again, something that you would want to hang on to, or you would eventually sell yourself?
We'll see. We could form an emotional attachment and keep it and just rent it out. Or if the market is good to sell it, we might do that. So it's just, something to do.
Experience gathering trip here today then.
Correct.
This batch of 130 homes came into the county's hands because their previous owners were delinquent on their taxes, in some cases for several years.
Some were listed with a minimum starting bid as low as $1,300. Auctioneer John Bippis presided over the sales.
What surprises you about these events whenever you do them, or what seems unexpected? I imagine auctions are a fairly orderly, predictable thing, but are there surprises along the way?
The surprises would be when you get something that is let go for tax foreclosure that was a mistake by a lender or somebody, something of significant value. And we do have some that happens from time to time. And so you're surprised at that one, that they're here, and then two, they do bring significant money sometimes. And we sold a house last year in this sale for $330,000. I mean, the tax liability was like $27,000. But there aren't very many of those.
So very possible then, and probable, that you could walk out of here with a 75-year-old home, maybe even newer, 1,200 square feet, if you're lucky, for $5,000-$6,000.
Exactly. That can happen. And it will happen today. Yeah.
Number 7's opened up. Thank you. That's the way to bid. Appreciate that. 52. 55 wares. Or another bid. 55 and now 57, 50, and 6,000. Will you bid 6,500? 6,500 and 7,000, 7,500, 8,000 here. 8,000, 85, and now 9. 9. Bid 9,500 and 10,000. 10. Bid 11.
Andy Markovich did not come to bid on this day, but he's no stranger to the auction process.
What's your incentive for coming to an auction?
Well, we try to get the best deal we can for property, and auction is a good way of getting the fair value of a property in your area.
You say we. Are you with a group?
Well, there's a group of us that have been buying properties together. We just kind of coach each other. They buy theirs, we buy ours. Go to each other for advice and stuff like that. Help even. And to help make our community better.
How do you see this playing out? Once you've bought the properties and they've been fixed up and maybe they've gone to different hands, how do you see Lansing improving because of your efforts?
Well, because we're fixing up the properties to give you a better self-esteem of your image of your neighborhood. If you want to go to a junky neighborhood, well, you don't want to live there. If you go to a neighborhood people are putting money into, people want to live there. And when you got people living there, that helps businesses. Businesses will grow, then that will in turn more employ more people, and then you'll have the growth that the city needs.
Do you try to be strategic about areas of the city or types of houses?
Yes. Yes, we try to go into the lower income neighborhoods that could really use the benefit and the help to bring the values and the self-preservation of the neighborhood back up.
So what's next for you? If you're not buying today, are you keeping your eye out for more things?
All the time. Yeah, there's more than just this auction, but this is by far the best auction.
Modesto Munoz is another believer. He bought his current home at an auction.
Our house was, I do believe, built in 1972, I believe, and we've been there for 2 years, and we paid $4,000 for it, and it's a beautiful home and needed a little touch and love, but we got her done.
Now Munoz is hoping to help a relative find the same opportunity he did.
So you have your brother-in-law here making his bid, or at least paying attention to the properties.
Yes, it's his first rodeo show, so we wanted him to get the comfort of it. So that's what we're here for, and hopefully he's going to be a successful bidder and blessed also. So we definitely want the best for him.
Ingham County will hold its final auction of the year September 30th. The public will have a chance to tour those properties the week before. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Don't forget, be looking for us tomorrow evening as we take the program to Adams Field, Michigan State University, between 6 and 7 o'clock as everybody prepares for the Spartan football home opener tomorrow evening against Jacksonville State. We'll be looking for you. Labor Day weekend is upon us, and with that, it means one last tourist-filled weekend up at Mackinac Island before the hotel owners and fud shops and temporary workers start battening down the hatches for another long winter. For many a Michigander, the Labor Day Mackinac Bridge Walk, in its 57th year, marks the unofficial end of summer. Published this summer, the new book, Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal, delves into the social, economic, and political events that have shaped the island for the last half century. It's written by perhaps the state's foremost expert on Mackinac, Dennis Cawthorn, a longtime politician and lobbyist here in Lansing. Dennis and Mackinac go back 54 years, from loading carriages in college to founding one of the island's most popular restaurants, the Village Inn, to heading the Mackinac Island State Park Commission. Dennis Cawthorn has seen a lot on Mackinac over the decades, and he joins me now to talk about some of the memories. Welcome to Current State, Dennis Cawthorn.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. It's a beautiful day, by the way, on Mackinac, and that's where I'm speaking to you from.
Well, that's verisimilitude, if ever I heard it. Why did you decide to write this book? Did it just all have to come out here after all this time on the island?
Well, after 54 years up here, being involved, as you have already indicated, in so many things, I just felt that there was a story to tell. And essentially, I thought that this was a book that would be unique, and I think it is, because it isn't the usual book about the architecture or the history or the fudge. It's really the story, the inside story of people and events here on Mackinac in the last 54 years or half century, and it really tries to give the true flavor of what Mackinac is really all about. And to do it in a way that is entertaining and also highly informative.
You started on the island loading carriages during the summer when you were in college. When was that, and what was the island like at that time?
Well, that was 1960, a long time ago. And as we say in the book, it really was sort of the beginning of a new era for the island. And the reason for that was that I-75 had just been completed, and so now there was a good fast route all the way, literally from Miami to Sault Ste. Marie. People could travel here very easily. The Mackinac Bridge had just opened on November 1st, 1957, and the island was basking in some very favorable national publicity. Saturday Evening Post had a big story on Grand Hotel and its owner, W. Stuart Woodfill. And finally, presidential candidate John F. Kennedy came to the island, actually trying to sew up the Democratic nomination for the presidency. So all these things sort of converged, and it just so happened that that was also my first year on the island. So it really was sort of the beginning of a new era.
What about since then, Dennis? People think of Mackinac Island as a place that hasn't changed in decades, but since 1960, what changes have you seen?
Well, number one, the total number of visitors is far greater now than it was then. In 1960, even though the bridge opened and I-75 opened, we only had in those days probably about 400,000 visitors a year. Now the island has, in any single year, probably pretty close to 800,000. What has not changed is the fact that 83% of the island is actually owned by the state of Michigan and is a state park, and there can't be any development on that 83%. So that means that we can be pretty sure that 83% of the island will basically not change. But on that 17% that is not state-owned, there has been a lot of change, a lot of new construction, a lot more businesses up here than there used to be. And so there have been a lot of developmental pressures that have, come into play. And we talk about those in the book and sort of how they came about and how they are resolved and what the outcome is.
Were we ever close to having cars on the island?
That's a good question. Actually, that's been a long-standing battle. The city of Mackinac Island, in the city part of the island, did ban the auto back in 1898. State Park did it a few years later, although they didn't really nail down the ban on the state park until much later. But over the years, yes, there have been pressures to allow cars. For example, during the Depression, the State Highway Commissioner actually proposed building a series of bridges from Sheboygan to Boblo Island to Round Island to Mackinac, and then to have a highway that circled the island and then leapt over the water via a bridge to St. Ignace.
Oh, my.
And he thought it would be, you know, one of the world's great scenic highways. And that came about as pressure from the Great Depression to sort of pump some life into northern Michigan's economy. But that went by the wayside. But we did have another incarnation of the battle in the 1970s when there was a lot of pressure to allow snowmobiles on the island. And eventually the State Park Commission did semi-capitulate, allowed snowmobiles for certain months in certain parts of the island. So, yeah, there's been a lot of pressure over the years.
Who is primarily resisting that pressure today?
Well, you know, I think the State Park Commission, you know, really is in the forefront of making sure that things don't get out of hand. However, you know, the city government here, generally speaking, despite a lot of pressure, has held the line quite well. And then there are locals who have really, you know, gone to great lengths to assure that we have good preservation. And in fact, several historic districts were created within the last year. And that came about as a result of local citizen involvement and pressure to protect areas that are not in the state park.
Dennis Cawthorn is our guest here on Current State, the author of the recently published book, Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal. Your book gets into some of the hilarity and hijinks, particularly in the politics that have happened on the island over the years. You mentioned JFK's visit there in 1960. What story rises to the top for you?
Well, gosh, there's you know, just a whole bunch of them. Harry Truman came to the island. This was a few years before I got here, but he met the island's mayor, and the island's mayor's last name was Goff, and that led to a rather famous introduction that probably is best read and not told on the air. The diminutive mayor self-introduced himself enthusiastically to the president of the United States, or rather the former president, and Grand Hotel's W. Stuart Woodfield had to quickly correct the mayor because the mayor's self-introduction involved some double entendre that the mayor never intended. Then, you know, one of our stories, too, is about the renovation of the governor's residence back when John Engler was governor. And John Engler liked this moose head that Frank Kelly had donated to the governor's residence. Mrs. Engler hated the moose head, but she made a deal with Governor Engler. Mrs. Engler said, if you will keep your nose out of the renovation project, I will let you keep the moose head that I so much detest. And so they struck a bargain. The moose head is there, I believe, to this day. And the renovation went on without a male's intervention.
What really happens on the island in the wintertime, Dennis?
Well, we have a whole chapter on that, too. And a lot of people are really intrigued by that. You know, what goes on Mackinac in the winter? And we talk about that, at some length. You know, about 500 people remain on the island during the winter. One thing that has changed is the usage of snowmobiles, which has made people in the winter really more mobile on the island than they are during the summer. And so whereas pre-snowmobile, the island really went to sleep in the winter, now, you know, there's a lot more, as I say, mobility. People can actually cross the ice, although it's not necessarily highly recommended. They can cross the ice to St. Ignace in the winter. They can go downtown for a meal in midwinter, whereas in the old days, people would literally have to trudge through snowdrifts a mile or two or even three to do some of these things.
Have you ever spent the winter there?
I have not spent the whole winter. I value my sanity. but I do, in the winter, usually visit at least once a month to take care of business. So I know what it's like, and I have crossed over on the ice to St. Ignace by snowmobile many times, and it's an experience. It's beautiful. And some people say it's more beautiful in the winter than it is in the summer. But you've got to be prepared to have only one or two restaurants, one or two watering holes, or one or two places to stay. You don't have the big variety you have during the summer.
Yeah, we don't want you to go Overlook Hotel on us there, Dennis. So
no,
there's a strong Native American presence on the island, even to this day. How has that shaped Mackinac?
Well, in the book, we talk about the sort of the cultural milieu of the island, if you will, and a lot of people don't realize it. But the Native American presence has always been very strong on the island. Now, somewhat less in recent years, but Native Americans, but more precisely French Indian, people of French Indian heritage, have always made up a large population or percentage of the population here. And that has always been a very strong presence. The other thing is, or the other element that historically has been very important to the island are Irish Americans. The Irish came over to the island, sometimes via Beaver Island, and very early on were the, along with the French Indians on the island, were the dominant ethnic group. And to this day, the island still has a very strong Irish heritage. And, of course, when JFK made his visit here in 1960, that was a very, very big thing, not just because it was the visit of a presidential candidate, but because the local Irish population swooned over JFK, mm-hmm. and that was a very big deal.
What do you think Mackinac will look like in, say, 50 years? You ever think about that?
Well, that's a good question. I think that it will still it will retain its charm and its beauty. Yes, there are a lot of development pressures, but I would say that that the island generally looks better and feels better than it has at any time in the past. Yeah, there have been some building projects that have been controversial and not popular, but overall, the feel of the island, the look of the island, the ambiance, I think, is the best it's ever been. And so I'm pretty confident that going forward, Mackinac is going to be a great place. And again, it's full of all sorts of colorful characters and great events that that this book really tries to portray.
Dennis Cawthorne is the author of the recently published book, Mackinac Island, Inside, Up Close, and Personal. Thanks for joining us, Dennis.
Thank you very much, Mark. My pleasure.
Paris, between the two world wars, was, by many accounts, a magical time. Writers, musicians, and artists flocked to the City of Lights from around the globe. The new novel by Francine Prose, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932, delves into that city's unique time period, and our book contributor Scott Southard has this review.
Paris, in the 1920s and 1930s, is the stuff of literary legend. It is hard for book lovers not to get lost in the mythology of it, imagining Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald discussing books over drinks at a club while couples dance to the greatest jazz music. Francine Prose is one such author captivated by this period, and in her new book, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932, she takes us through the fall of this great city, from its decadent and free heyday to its occupation under Nazi Germany. The book makes you feel like you're breathing the air of that city, walking those same rain-swept and romantic streets. No character in Prose's book best mirrors the fall of Paris than the tragic Lou Villers. In the beginning, we are introduced to her ill-fated journey, from upcoming athlete and race car driver to Nazi informant and torturer. She is a captivating creation, and even though all of the warning signs are there right from the start of this expansive novel, you can't help but wish that her path could be changed, that history could be rewritten for this lost and desperate soul. Not your typical novel, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932, is a fascinating investigation into the limits of one's perception. Prose's book is not told through chapters, but through excerpts from biographies, letters, and even newspaper articles. Therefore, this book is told through many voices, each holding only one part of the whole. And while not each entry gets the story or facts entirely right, the truth comes together like a mystery novel told in reverse. Besides the tragic Lou, this book is filled with personalities you might have seen if you were lucky enough to walk those Paris streets. Lionel Main is a struggling novelist from New Jersey, hoping to find his book in the City of Lights. Yvonne is the loud owner of the Chameleon Club, and Gabor is a Hungarian photographer with an eye for capturing fleeting moments. Historical figures make appearances throughout, including Picasso and a tense chapter with Hitler at the Berlin Olympics. If there is one flaw with Prose's novel, it would be a technical one. While this book is told through many different individuals, the voice behind the other voices never really deviates as you would expect. It is still very much Francine Prose driving the race car, leaving all these characters and entries pretty much sounding the same. Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932, is an ambitious novel that nearly hits its mark. The story is filled with fascinating twists and turns, and even though the Paris from this golden age is gone, it was nice to return to it in Francine Prose's novel, if only for a few hundred pages. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
And Scott's the author of two novels. Starting September 1st, he'll be taking part in a virtual blog tour for his book, A Jane Austen Daydream. You can follow along online at Historical Fiction Virtual Book Tours or via his website, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard at sdsouthard.com. That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, join us for a special evening broadcast at 6 p.m. We're live from Adams Field on the MSU campus for the start of the Spartan football season. Our defending Rose Bowl champions take on Jacksonville State in the home opener. Join us at 6 o'clock, and we'll be looking for you at Adams Field. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.